The following Dharma discourse was given by Jeffrey Shugen Arnold at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugen Roshi is the head of the Mountains and Rivers Order and abbot of the monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about our various programs, visit us online at zmn.org. Thank you for listening.
This is from the Koans of the Way of Reality. Yunju is abiding in the mountains. In ancient times, a student once asked Master Yunju, "Ultimately, what is a true practitioner like?" Yunju said, "Abiding well in the mountains." The student did a prostration and stood up. Yunju said, "How do you understand this?" And the student said, "Within the realms of good and bad, life and death, favor and adversity, a practitioner's mind ultimately is immovable like a mountain." Yunju struck him and said, "You've betrayed the former sages and destroyed my descendants." Yunju then asked the student next to the first student, said, "How do you understand this?" That student made a prostration and stood up and said, "A practitioner ultimately abides in the mountains, with eyes not seeing the colors of sky and earth, with ears not hearing the music of bamboo and strings." Yunju said, "You too have betrayed the former sages and destroyed my descendants." Naroshi's commentary. Master Yunju was the first generation heir of Dongshan. It's Yunju's line that continues down to the present time. It's clear from the question that this student is headed in a direction that will only result in complications, not clarity. Yunju headed this off by saying, "Abiding well in the mountains. See how he goes in all directions at once." This doesn't mean being concealed in the mountains and rejecting the world, nor does it mean rejecting the mountains while being in the world. In actual fact, to abide well in the mountains is a flower opening in the world. When they were tested, it turned out that this student was trying to make a living in a ghost cave, so Yunju struck them. Putting aside the student's answer, how do you understand abiding well in the mountains? Yunju then turned his attention to the second student, saying, "How do you understand it?" The student stumbled and fell into the same hole as the first one, two dead people ready for burial. "Tell me, how do you avoid betraying the former sages and destroying future generations? Say a word." So this is a dialogue taken from the records that Dada Roshi put into this assembly of koans called the Way of Reality, which is the name of the monastery, Doshinji. But he never published it. He never really finalized it. I have just the collection of all the talks that he gave or the koans that he assembled. It's in very rough form. But this is one of them. And as he said, Yunju was a descendant of Dongshan, which is the beginning of the Soto school. And so he's in our lineage. And one day he said, "Hell is not a great misery." He said, "The greatest misery is to wear these clothes but not understand the great matter." What is a true practitioner like? So as we near the end of this session, could be a timely question. What is a true practitioner like? But what is the student asking? In the koan, the student working with the koan has to really enter into the mind, not by speculating, conjecturing, but really trying to go in directly, given just what's apparent here. And of course, they bring their own mind into it. So is this student asking, how should I act? What's the proper way to behave? How will Dharma practice change me? What will I look like then? How does a sincere practitioner practice in every moment? Is a student asking about their ultimate nature? Ultimately, what is a true practitioner like? But why does Dada Roshi say it's clear from the question that students heading in a direction that will only result in complications, not clarity? Students often worry, as I did, about asking the wrong question, a foolish question, a question that might actually reveal that we're not enlightened yet, that might, you know, make the teacher think that we're not worthy. I certainly had those concerns. If it's a sincere question, how could it be wrong? It could be understood as, tell me what to do. Tell me how to act, tell me how to speak, tell me how to think. Yunzhu could have said, be a true practitioner, and then I'll tell you. And there is a tension, a necessary tension, or a thing, that when we come in to practice and training, you know, if you're just practicing on your own, I did that for 10 years, it was just me. Buddhism, as far as I knew, was meditation. That was it. And me. I mean, I knew it was out there somewhere, that it existed, that it was in other countries. It had been around a long time, but I didn't know anything about it. Back then, it was hard to find out about it, really. But when we enter into a sangha, we enter into a community, bunch of people, training, staff, teachers, teachings, precepts, monastic rules. And so there's a kind of tension in terms of how to be true to yourself. In other words, how to not to just sort of put on a Dharma costume, thinking that that's what you're supposed to do or that's what's going to affect change. And at the same time, we are entering into something, right? A sangha is not just a random collection of confused people. It's a very intentional collection of confused people. Just kidding. And if we are sincere, then we're asking for help. Like, what is practice? What are the teachings? What should I be bringing my attention to? What is actually skillful and unskillful? How do I respond to this and to this and to this? How do I begin to live my life in accord with the Dharma? What does that even mean? And so from the very beginning, there's a sense of entering into a sangha, a shared world, right? That we're not just making it up, it's come down to us. And so in that way, there are views, there are teachings, there are ways of being that are right on, and there are ways of being that aren't, right? That aren't going to work, not only for the individual, but not for the sangha. And so, and then there's forms, right? We do things in certain ways to cultivate mindfulness, to bring us together as one body. And so the power of that is that, you know, we're not just out there flying blind, that we're actually able to enter into and begin to look and observe and absorb and take on, right? But how to do that and not just it not be like a kind of groupthink sort of thing. Say this, do this, sort of put it on the exterior, and that's sufficient. It's not sufficient. That's not what it's really coming from the inside. But in a sense, we have to start from the outside. We enter into something that is that which we're seeking. And so there's a dynamic, right, that we have to work our way through. And so some people might easily, maybe too easily, just take it on, you know. I mean, imitation sounds bad. It's not altogether bad. It happens in a lot of disciplines. You imitate your teacher. When I was studying music, my teacher would play something and say, now play it. And he wanted me to listen to what I just heard and try and repeat that. It's a very old, ancient way of learning. But there's a way of doing that that just sits on the surface of the skin that's very superficial. That's obviously not what we're trying to do here. So some might err in that way. Others will rebel and resist while engaging. And both can work. You know, both can be just a beginning because that's what the person is bringing in. That's their karma. That's the way they're responding. And if there's sincerity, that's going to go through some changes, right? The person who's just taking things on too easily is going to learn how to really make it their own, integrate it. And the person who's resisting is going to need to work with that resistance, right? Resistance is interesting, right? Because it's, if the person just didn't care, there would be no resistance. But resistance is like there's a little bit of a tug of war going on, a friction going in both directions, attraction as well as pulling back. So in a way, both are okay if we take responsibility, practice it well. You know, when I was thinking when I was in high school, you know, there were various groups. There was the bookish kids, and I was, you know, I liked school. I did well, but I wasn't really part of the bookish crowd. There was the stoners. You know, we call them potheads. And I did drugs, but I wasn't really a pothead. And I played sports, but I wasn't really a jock. And it was like, you know, people want to know, well, what group are you actually in? The coach, when I was playing football, one day called me and said, now, son, I see you out there with them long hairs in the smoking area. He said, you got to figure out which team you're on because this ain't going to work. I had long hair. Well, I tried to have long hair. During football season, they wouldn't allow it, and that was a constant tug. When I see these professional football players with hair down to their asses, I think, oh, I miss my time. It all comes down to working towards being in accord with the Dharma, which is being in accord with oneself, one's true nature. They're not two. And so in a sense, we're bringing the outside in is one way of thinking of it, right? There is a kind of alchemy. But it doesn't begin there. There's already something rumbling inside that needs to come out, needs to find its expression, needs to find an affinity, right? That's what happens when we encounter the Dharma and we experience something, right, that pulls. And so we hear the teachings, we reflect on them, we practice, put them into practice, and then we do that again, and we do that again, we do that again. You know, and to say, to make the practice my own in America, what, you know, in our culture can mean, you know, take it and throw everything away and just come up with something new. That's not what it means. It means to make it your body and mind, the Dharma itself, by letting go of the self. So when this student asked Yunju this question, what is a true practitioner like? Yunju said, abiding well in the mountains. So the student bows. Yunju says, how did you understand this? And Dadaroshi in his comments says, and it says, Yunju wants to know what kind of bow is. Why are you bowing? What are you expressing in that bow? One action, one gesture can be different things because it's not fixed, because nothing is. And so a bow can be expressing a number of different things. And so Yunju wanted to know, what have you seen? What did you just hear that you're doing a bow right now? Abiding well in the mountains. Dadaroshi says, see how Yunju goes in all directions at once. I think that's really beautiful. That one statement, he goes in all directions at once. Then he says, to clarify, this doesn't mean being hidden in the mountains and rejecting the world, right? Which is a lot of what a lot of us probably would like to do in the beginning of practice. It's an historical pursuit, right? To recognize there's a problem here, I need to go somewhere else where that problem is not, right? But not recognizing that the problem, the essential problem, is within us. It goes where we go. But he says, nor does it mean rejecting the mountains while being in the world. So not being, while being in the world, rejecting practice, inquiry, meditation, the inner life. In actual fact, who abide well in the mountains is a flower opening in the world. He's quoting Dogen here. So how do you understand going in all directions at once? This is really the heart of the koan. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart, one should cherish all living beings, radiating kindness over the entire world, upwards to the skies, downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. All directions at once. Whole body and mind, wholehearted, no boundaries, self fallen away, radiating kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy. That's why this is such an important practice. Remember that this practice that we do every morning began with the Buddha. That's how old it is. And it was an important practice. It's always been an important practice, an emphasized practice, a meditation. And right there, he's saying, you know, it's not just a matter of saying words. Ultimately, it's not just a matter of wishing well for this person, or even as you extend that out in the way that it's taught towards your ultimate enemies. Yes, that is a practice, but then now, go larger. All directions. In every direction. Abiding well is to not abide in any place. To abide in non-abiding. To not dwell inside or outside. On the mountain or in the world. That's the thing we're working towards. Is realizing that every boundary, right, is self-created. It can have a function in a teacher-student relationship. There are boundaries that are really, really important. So that both the teacher and the student understands what is that relationship about. Why are we facing each other? So that we can know if and when that boundary is crossed. Because at that moment, there's a problem. But when you build a fence to define your property from your neighbor's, the fence doesn't know this side and that side. It's just wood or stone. To not dwell on inside or outside as a monastic or a lay, as a deluded being or enlightened being. I think of simple things that have subtle depth, like sitting here in this hall with your eyes open, turning inward. Your senses are open, your eyes are open. Even if they're lowered, there's still some field of vision, there's some light coming through, which is important. Not just for wakefulness, but so that you're turning in into the mountain isn't rejecting the world. And that ultimately that sense of inner or outer dissolves. Because there is no real boundary. Your voice when you're chanting and the voice of the Sangha. To be able to bring your voice out and also have it blend. So if it rises above, right, that's not blending. If it's discordant, well, work on that. Abiding well is not dependent upon the mountains. This is not about the mountains. Abiding well in the mountains could be anywhere, everywhere. He goes in all directions at once. To be non-abiding, to abide well is to be non-abiding, is to not abide in not abiding. We can attach to non-attachment. We can objectify anything. It's just a subtle sleight of mind. And so in practice, we're studying the mind, we're studying our karma, we're learning how to be adept at recognizing the self in its various manifestations, to meet it without love or hate, right? Not cherishing, grasping, being enamored, infatuated, and building that self up more, not hating it, being irritated by it, seeing it as inherently obstructive, being able to experience the tensions that arise in various moments, and to be able to, and to develop an ease within that discomfort. In a way, that's very natural. We know exactly how to do that. We have that capacity within us. In another way, it's radical. It's revolutionary. How much of that do you see going on in the wild, wild world? Actually holding, not just enduring, not suppressing, that's not holding, not blaming, not making excuses. I mean, there's, you know, we have all of these ways, human beings historically, but also culturally, societally, technologically, right? To not hold our discomfort and to be encouraged in a thousand enticing ways. That's what's so profound about this. It's so simple and it's so important. That's why we create an environment that is conducive, but not too comfortable enough, but not too comfortable. Will bring some challenges, but not too much, not more than is appropriate for what we're trying to do. The self is by its own definition limiting. A self is a limit. When the Buddha said delusion is I am, that's a limit. That's a demarcation. That's a noun. I am this. And that means simultaneously, I am not that. And there's, this is just one aspect of I am this, and there are hundreds, thousands of ways in which we identify. And so that self-definition, that self-limiting, right? Sadarashi said, not going in all directions at once, but just right here, held back, defined. And so how could that possibly change? How do we even recognize those limitations? I mean, they're just me. They're not limitations. This is just who I am. That's the way it appears. And so I have to come up against, it's like, how do you know if you're in the dark, how do you know there's a fence in front of you or a wall? Well, you run into it. That's how you know, right? Boom. Oh, I guess there's something there. And that's pretty much what happens. We're just sailing along, and boom, we come up against something that pushes back, that doesn't yield, right? Maybe hurts, depending on how fast we were going. And that's some aspect of me, right? The teachings say that there are characteristics of a Dharma person. This isn't a Tibetan Buddhist teaching. Passionless. And to be without passion is very tricky in our language, particularly in our culture, because we think of passion as being passionate, caring, being wholehearted, engaged. It doesn't mean that. It means to be afflicted by overwhelming emotions. And so to be passionless doesn't mean to be dead. It's just the opposite. It's coming to life, but not at the mercy of these overpowering afflictive emotions. Contentment. To be contained doesn't always mean to be, you know, self-satisfied. It means to be contained, sufficient, in a sense, to know how to be satisfied with yourself while traveling, which means to be satisfied with yourself while hungry, while tired, while cranky, while opinionated. Fewer activities to let drop away what's not necessary. I mean, how much of our inner dialogue is actually necessary? You don't even want to chart that, right? Simplify, simplify, right? It's a basic monastic virtue to realize that our activities are wondrous in their simplicity, to simplify. Good conduct, to be willing to work with ourselves. To just not create so much trouble, for crying out loud. And to do good, just to do some good. And then some more, and then some more. Simple, essential, awareness. In this teaching, it's awareness of the teacher. To learn how to relate to the teacher. You know, when I was a Jisha for my teacher, for Dada Roshi, and I was practicing serving him, I'd like to go back and be able to do that over, because I think I would do it better than I did before. I was so, yeah. So to be able to serve, but I did realize that in learning how to do this, that ultimately it wasn't just that I could serve him, that in a sense he was helping me to learn just how to serve, just how to be of service. To cultivate prajna, wisdom, to know your mind. Kindness, to cultivate kindness, to really appreciate how powerful that is and what it is. Because it's not always what we think. And to remember, what do we need to remember? What we have forgotten. Well, there are certain things that we would do well to forget, to let drop away. But there are other things we need to remember. We need to keep in front of us. But when we're not in all directions at once, it's like sitting in a box. You know, these characteristics are, you could say it's the answer to what is a true practitioner looks like. It's like things to reflect on. You know, there's a basic practice of it at the end of the day, just reflecting. You know, just scan. You know, what do I see? What have I learned? What do I need to learn from? What do I need to incorporate? What do I need to be more attentive to? And these qualities, and there are, Buddhism is replete with many lists of virtuous qualities, and all of them are intended to just reflect on those particular aspects. Which is why the judging mind is so important to practice releasing ourselves from, right? Because it is sort of the antithesis of in all directions at once. It is the fence builder, the wall builder, the higher and lower builder, who's right and who's wrong builder. So when the student did the prostration, Yunju said, well, how do you understand this? Why do you bow? And the student said, within the realms of good and bad, life and death, favor and adversity, all the dualities, a practitioner's mind ultimately is immovable like a mountain. That sounds like Dharma you've encountered. To sit like a mountain, to develop that stability, to not be so subject, so susceptible to all the things that rise and fall. You know, Sancho spoke the other day about developing a thick skin. What really it is what I was speaking about the other day. It might seem like that, but it's really losing your skin. In a way, it's becoming so permeable that as things enter, you feel them because the defenses are dropping, but you don't hold them. You don't take them on. They're not yours. Even if it's an emotion that is arising with you, it's not yours. It's not you. It is not to be possessed. It is to be experienced, the Buddha said very clearly. He's very clear and succinct about this. He said, it is to be experienced. It is not you. It doesn't belong to you. It arises and falls. That's it. But the judging mind doesn't work like that. It sticks. It's sticky. Right? It establishes. It puts stakes down. That's why the skandhas are so important. The Buddha said ultimately dukkha is the clinging skandhas. And so form, the body, right? The basis upon which we experience everything. Sensation, another translation describes that as appraisal, which I like, appraisal. What is this? Sensation, the body comes into contact with something. What is it? Right? That's the first thing we want to know. And then it begins to develop. Conception is how we translate it. Another translation is impulse. Now that I have identified it, what do I want to do with it? Right? I mean, just think of how sort of acquisitional the skandhas are, right? And how self-referential. That's why the Buddha said the skandhas are the person. They are how we think of ourselves, how we think ourselves into being. And now each of those aspects is moving towards acquisition. I am, I am not. I want, I don't want. I love, I hate. And so the impulse to what do I do with it, and then knowing, being aware. And so when the student said, within the realm of good and bad, life and death, the mind is immovable like a mountain, Yunju struck the student, said, you have betrayed the former sages and destroyed my descendants. You know, it's really important to appreciate in these teachings and with this style, striking shouts, which was a style of a time and a period. It's not punitive. It's really important to understand. I mean, in the Buddha's time, when they would gather regularly and go through all the moral teachings, the monastic codes, and people would atone for whatever they'd done, and then there were consequences, depending on the severity of the transgression. But it wasn't punishment, right? Karma is not a system of reward and punishment, right? That those responses were trying to help the student take responsibility, and then which includes dealing with the consequences of what they've done. And so sometimes in some transgressions, just owning up to it was enough because it was so slight. That's all that was needed. But others required more. And it's a way of helping the student to reflect on, to take responsibility for, to begin to transform that those actions that are not helpful to them or to the Sangha. But this is very different. This is not about that. This is not about a morality lesson or a transgression at all. Why does Yunju strike the student? The student presents being immovable like a mountain. The student presents their understanding, their mind, their view, and Yunju strikes them, startles them, shakes that mountain. To what end? Into what? To shake them loose of what state of mind? To bring forth what? The student asked a question. What is a true practitioner like? Yunju is trying to help the student to directly see that. The next student responds in the same way. Bows, stands up. A practitioner ultimately abides in the mountains. Eyes don't see colors. Ears don't hear sounds. Yunju said, you too have betrayed the sages and destroyed my descendants. A student was once leaving their teacher after having completed their training. And they said, I vow to continue to follow the Buddha way and I will not disappoint you. And the teacher said, don't worry about not disappointing me. Don't disappoint yourself. Immovable as a mountain, not seeing colors, not hearing sounds. Yunju wants them to come to life. That's why Dada Roshi said there are two dead people ready for burial. There's physical death. There's samsaric death. You know, I spoke about just being sort of in a sleep state. There's a spiritual kind of death of attachment. Attachment to silence, to stillness, to emptiness, that is a rejection of the world, that is turning away, is looking for a nest, is looking to abide. This didn't work. This will work. I'm willing to give that up, but I got this. And so the teacher's responsibility is to always try and push them off the cliff, out of the nest, so that we develop that kind of facility, being in the world and not leaving the mountain, being on the mountain, not leaving the world. I think it's reasonable to say that it's the most difficult aspect of practice. You know, it's been acknowledged over the centuries that to spin in samsara is easy. Just keep doing what you've been doing, right? Don't do anything. Just live by habit. To try and shift that takes a considerable, effortful, sincere, joyful, sustained effort. That inward journey, turning the light around, to integrate those, unify. It's not even integration, is a little, because really it's unifying, right? It's just dissolving the barrier, you know, between where the practice happens and where it doesn't. What is sacred and what's not? What is dharma? Which really means what has the capacity to teach me, to show me, to reveal to me. Dogen said that the understanding that this present moment, meaning any present moment, offers you no further passage, is not a doorway. He said, that's not Buddhist practice. A very sort of decisive statement. So of course, to put it in the positive, this present moment is offering you further passage. That's Buddhist study. That sounds wonderful, doesn't it? What is that? How is that? That's the practice of every student, is to ask that question, to ask it of the teachings, to ask it of your teacher, to ask it of yourself, and to keep asking. How is this showing me? When I met with the One Continuous Thread folks last night, one of our students, very sincere student who is very cued into what's going on in the world and is deeply troubled by it, ask a correct question. He said, what do I do with the feeling of aversion that I feel inside of myself? Right. That's Buddhist study. What do I do with this? Because implicit within that is a taking of responsibility for what I am experiencing. Right. The news does not make me feel one way or another. Another person's action does not give me anger. And so that rightly asked question is, how can I practice this? How is that further passage, offering me further passage? And so we have to recognize it. We have to abide lightly in it. Don't suppress, don't dwell. Be uncomfortable. Don't know. Start there. Don't know. We so quickly look for answers because heaven knows it. Answers are needed, right? But that's also our trap, right? The world is not a toaster, right? It just needs a new filament. You just need to put in a new this or that. We are not a machine that just needs a new part. It's a complex system. To abide well, isn't that really what we've been practicing, whether you know it or not, all week, to abide well. And when we do that, you know, that's why the attempt to bring about peace and harmony through anger and rage is not going to work. It may bring about some change, but not for long. If I have traveled a long road with anger and rage as my mode, what makes me think I'm going to know how to be peaceful, to be kind, to be contented, if I haven't been practicing that? And so to abide well in every moment, which doesn't mean every moment suits your desires, right? That's what we're learning to free ourselves of. Abide well in this moment, not the one of your choosing, the one that has come to you. Single Dharma is the essence of all Dharmas, Dadarishi said. The myriad Dharmas penetrate the one Dharma. Mind only, nature only. How can we say that they're different or the same? So, let us abide well within the remainder of this session. Whatever you've experienced, whatever you're experiencing, that just comes and goes. When you really don't know and you practice, as the Buddha said, right, in all directions, give yourself wholeheartedly, then the door of your mind, the door of practice, remains wide open. And you will see at different moments unexpected turns, unexpected shifts. And even if something just persists, it might be difficult, then you are developing incalculably important qualities of faith and trust and perseverance and stability and resilience. So it's a basic Buddhist principle. Don't waste anything.
Thank you for listening. To find out more about ZMM's programs, retreats, and residency, please visit us online at zmm.org.